Good afternoon. If you are very lucky in life, you will in your formative years come across somebody who will have a profound influence in bringing out the best of whatever it is you have to offer. And that was certainly my experience of our speaker this afternoon, Bill Wedderburn. He arrived from Cambridge in 1964 as the newly appointed Castle Professor of Commercial Law here at the LSE. He was a remarkably youthful 37-year-old, and I was an even more youthful but wholly unremarkable second-year undergraduate. His was a truly imaginative appointment, and looking back now, it is obvious that the hands of Jim Gower and Otto Kahn-Freund had done some of their best work to the enduring benefit of the LSE. The unanimous reaction of all my contemporaries was that here was one of the all-time great law teachers, and he certainly set us alight. And I know that all subsequent generations of his students have had that same magical experience. Before long, we were devouring everything he had written, for example, about the mysteries of corporate personality and the obscurities of the preposterously named rule in Foss and Harbottle. But of course, the most stimulating moments were reserved for lectures and tutorials, which were devoted to an analysis of the real reason that Bill Wedderburn came to this earth, and in particular to the LSE. And I refer, of course, to the decision of the House of Lords in Rooks and Barnard in 1964. Now, in the right hands, that case was, and I hope still is, a most perfect teaching platform. You observe the genius of the process of common law reasoning at its best. You see the judges making new law and pretending no such thing. And you appreciate in a dramatic way the dawning realization that there just may be some relationship between the real world and the law. Now, there are many other things I could say, and indeed I would love to say, but this afternoon, he is the lecturer, and I am only introducing him, and if I may say so, welcoming his wife, Frances, who's with us here this evening, and I must say I'm particularly pleased to see her here. The lecture has an intriguing title and spans virtually the whole of a dynamic century in the field of labour law. Bill Wedderburn has been largely responsible for producing order out of chaos in the teaching of this field, and I cannot wait to hear what he has to say. Bill Wedderburn.
Well, there comes a moment when they do it better than you do it yourself. They also, and this is a new phenomenon for me, Tony has, in fact, made it very difficult for me to pronounce my first sentence of this attempt to look at Lasky's law behind the law. But I'll do it nevertheless. What I wanted to say was that very few scholars had the lasting effect that Harold Lasky had on his students. Ralph Miliband, who was one of them, said that he gave all to his students out of a glowing faith that youth was generous and alive and eager, enthusiastic and fresh. Everyone writes about his invitation, "If you disagree, come and tell me where I'm wrong." Distinguished scholars of very different views, such as Max Beloff, have paid tribute to his part in founding political science and, as a committed socialist, to his disinterested devotion to the pursuit of truth. Ralph Dahrendorf suggests that the question, "Did you hear Lasky?" Is a historical watershed at the school. Unhappily, I myself missed him by a whisker, arriving in Cambridge at the very moment that the school left its wartime home there in 1945. And instead of hearing Lasky, I was met by graffiti scrawled by the young gentleman on the walls near the cam that read, "Burn Lasky." But then Lasky was chair of a Labour Party that had just won a general election. Now, it's fashionable to say that Lasky's true legacy was his teaching. But if we put fashion aside, And look, we do find, in my submission, unexpected insights on labour law and on the forces behind that law. I want to touch upon those in the early period, then in the later writings, though a full treatment must await a written version, not least, as my ex-students would expect, in the footnotes. Now, Lasky participated in political science in theory and in practice. He participated in what Hugo Sintzheimer, the professor of Kant Freund in Frankfurt in 1922, called the totality in which a scholar must participate in this area. Sintzheimer, one of the founders of modern labour law, later a minister in the Weimar government who introduced works councils. And for those who find their vocation in labour law, as one of my colleagues has called it, this legacy is a challenge indeed. Such participation should have caused no difficulty at the school, because the school constitution has always been a remarkable guarantee of freedom of belief and expression. But such freedoms demand diligence and vigilance. Lasky was at one time threatened in the 1930s by sanctions by the then autocratic director, Beveridge, who 10 years before had honourably defended him from such attacks because he wrote regular articles in the Labour newspaper, the Daily Herald, and had made a speech in Moscow which was transmuted by the Daily Telegraph spin doctors of the time into a call for violent revolution. The school was attacked in Parliament, and one anti-Semitic member condemned the work of this communist LSE professor of alien origins. Now, although Lasky was not a lawyer, he wrote, "My own subject does border at every point upon the law." And his participation included participation in such bodies as the Arbitration Industrial Court, which brought him into contact with aspects of labour relations law. The first encounters, however, with the common law were more American than English. After a little science, he turned to history at Oxford, where the surroundings drew out his emergent socialism. And from a short-term teaching post in Montreal, Lasky was whisked off to spend 4 years in Harvard Law School. There he dazzled everyone, as it is always written, wherever he was. Book review editor of the Harvard Law Review within 18 months, author of seminal legal articles which are still influential in European legal literature. He wrote, he studied, he taught, entering a circle of brilliant young lawyers around Mr. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, especially Felix Frankfurter. These links with Holmes and with American law and culture in general were ever after central to Lasky's life. And both he and Holmes carried on a correspondence until Holmes' death in 1935. And between them ran a depth of engagement to the intellect, a commitment to pluralist free thought. Although psychologically oriented commentators noted that on his very first visit to Holmes' household, Lasky inadvertently left behind his hairbrush. In 1920, Lasky, at the age of 27, joined the staff of the school where he spent the remaining 3 decades of his life, in a condition not unfamiliar, I think, to overworked young colleagues of today and yesterday, with, it's been put, a body of scholarly attainments, a young family, doubtful health, and sizable debts. Holmes wrote, "My dear lad, there is no other man I shall miss so much." Now, in the early period, when Lasky came to look at labour law in Britain in the 1920s, and later as a member of the Donoghue Committee on Ministers' Powers, he did so, therefore, with a background already comparative and full of social purpose. He found British law teachers rather stuffy black-letter lawyers. At one point, he calls them an inferior set of people who taught because they couldn't succeed at the bar. But not at the school, because at the school, the battle had long before been joined for a different brand of legal scholarship. Labour law courses began at the school in 1903, and in 1934, Dr. Robson gives a course on comparative industrial law, dealing with Britain, the United States, France, Soviet Russia, and Italy, all covered in the summer term, and all in 6 lectures. And truly, they were giants in those days. But here was a home for Lasky's belief that law, properly taught, should, as he said, wrestle with principles as well as memorize conclusions, suggest vistas of change, even while it seeks to convey a picture of the contemporary position. More like the great continental law schools at Bologna, or the American law schools like Harvard. It was the lawyer's function to make his doctrines keep step with the spirit of the time. When I read that, I remember I was reminded of John Griffith's classic summary of the rather different official British ideology under which judges may be allowed to move or capable of moving with the times, but, added Griffith, their function in our society is to do so belatedly. Now, in this congenial setting, Lasky turned his pen on the manifest hostility in the common law courts to trade unions, the Taft Vale case in 1901, where the law lords turned the law on its head to make trade unions quasi-corporate defendants, and the creation of new liabilities such as civil conspiracy at the time. As Lasky's colleague Jenks put it, the House of Lords first invented a new civil offence and then created a new kind of defendant against whom it could be alleged. Lasky castigated the Osborne case, where you remember a perverted ultra vires doctrine was used to ban trade union political activity, and he naturally exposed the social premises, which look so absurd to us today, when the law lord's decision in 1925 that payment of high wages at equal rates to men and women by local authorities was unreasonable, prompted, Lord Atkinson said, by some eccentric principles of socialistic philanthropy or by a feminist ambition to secure the equality of the sexes. One cannot pretend that nothing has changed since then. But there was no question in Lasky's mind ever of corruption. And in this, his analysis is more incisive than some. Common law judges were the object of admiration in the world, he wrote, in terms of corruption. But they were unable to reconcile themselves to the view that organizations of working men may legitimately interfere with the legal rights of businessmen to do what they will with their own. In this early period, he was disposed to think that the problem sprang mainly from a failure of misunderstanding. Above all, the reliance upon what Mr. Justice Holmes called the judicial inarticulate major premise. The real root of conflict, wrote Lasky in 1925, is ignorance. Now, this early period must be distinguished from his later thinking and categorized in a way that will help us when we look at today's reforms. The break is about 1935, curiously enough, the year of Holmes's death, although I've never come across anything that suggests causation in those two events. The early analysis was pluralist, rationalist, the correction of unconscious prejudice, and not strongly marked by a class analysis. He concentrated on the training of the lawyer. The lawyer should have, in his view, a philosophic grasp of the subject, and it would be disastrous if judges, for all their sincerity, appeared to be the unconscious servants of any dominant class. The inarticulate major premise was once again his target. He advocated a new system of training and organization to equip lawyers with a functional organization and understanding of industrial relations, as the Donovan Royal Commission was to do 4 decades later. We must, said Holmes, and Lasky adopted it, end the present divorce between political economy and the law. I wonder if we have. He also called for a law reform commission and for a system of tripartite industrial tribunals of very limited jurisdiction, and to cure perverse interpretations of statutes. In 1932, he called for extended preambles or official memoranda to enactments as invaluable guides for judges in their task of discovering what the statute is really intended to mean. I always think that nothing illustrated better than that his belief in the early work that rational process would do the trick. The early analysis of the 1920s does contain a surprising number of original items. Equal pay is advanced and is not now regarded as eccentric. though it may be permissible to question how many women really do receive equal pay for work of equal value. And the importance of preambles in legislation has, of course, been forced especially on our attention by the methods of European law. Judges even look, as Lasky suggested, at Hansard for good or ill. I must say, sometimes, not always for good. But Lasky's own social analysis took a new turn in the next two decades, to which let me come after a small parenthesis. There was a special nature of this early period, one which is perhaps not yet fully researched in all sorts of ways. The years between 1918 and 1925 were highly significant in British labour law and in other areas of our law. Before what is sometimes said rather crudely to be Lasky's move towards Marxism, no scholar of Lasky's sort could fail from the outset to inquire after the relationship between ignorance or inarticulate premises and the more objective social causes. Like the Webbs and Holmes himself, he recognised, as they put it, true liberty of contract can begin only where equality of bargaining power begins. And we should not, think that this truism is universally accepted even today. Even today, if one may have a parenthesis within a parenthesis, the law lords appear still to be resolved that the common law must not adopt a realistic understanding of the subordination of the worker. Only this year, they yet again reinforced the employer's right to impose individual contracts by discrimination against trade unionist employees. One law lord, quite correctly, bewailing the way in which the decision would lead to more victimisation of trade unionists, but he felt, even in this age of teleological interpretation, apparently unable to dissent. So strong is the common law image and model. The earliest period of Lasky's work, then, coincided with a special set of conditions. There were two elements. First, for a short period in the early 1920s, most decisions by English judges on labour law evinced an unusual and rare judicial abstention. We can now see that this is exceptional. Secondly, the intellectual tenor of the times invoked special reasons for self-doubt and analysis. As to the first, many judges refused to expand common law liabilities. The creative liability of the Taff Vale kind was not taken up by the majority of the judgments in the very early 1920s, in conspiracy, in intentional procurement of breach of contract, or, at the time, very important heading, for threats or coercion. Beyond that, senior judges of an otherwise conservative bent broke through English reserve in a quite unique way. They spoke self-analytically in public, as in the famous lecture of Lord Justice Scruton, whom Lasky called a great lawyer, a powerful mind, and a great gentleman. Scruton said impartiality, which was so easy to find in the commercial court, was more difficult to attain between two disputants, one of your own class and one not of your class. He was not speaking, of course, he made it plain, of conscious partiality, any more than was Lasky. But he spoke, he said, of the habits you are trained in, the people with whom you mix, being educated and nursed in the same ideas as the employers, which leave you having a certain class of ideas. And even outside trade unionist cases, to some extent in workmen's compensation, it is sometimes difficult to be sure, hard as you've tried, that you put yourself in a perfectly impartial position between two litigants. Scruton's remarkable lecture suggested that very special forces, both social and personal, were at work. One, surely, was the shock of a war in which the flower of a generation of men had been slaughtered, and the ambiance of guilt left with those in power who survived. Although bitter industrial conflict exploded in the mines and on the railways for a short period, some judges did pursue this path of consensus, parallel to the push for tripartite arrangements in industry, joint industrial councils, emerging after the Whitley reports, the pacts on dilutees, and the restoration of pre-war practices. It was a period when what has been called the social filter
determining ideas allowed into the consciousness was often displaced, permitting explicit examination about class and about humanity to come out from its customary repression. The staff officer who went to Passchendaele only in 1918 at the end cried out, "Good God, did we really send men to fight in that?" And the frivolous upper class encapsulated in vile bodies left the older survivors with Hamlet's shame to have seen the soldiers go to their graves like dead beds and fight for a plot which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. Lasky had been rejected for military service, and he often wrote to Holmes about how he felt humble in the presence of distinguished survivors. But this was a period in which the new science of psychology also began to have effect. Freud and Jung gave their first lectures abroad in Massachusetts in this period, or earlier than this period, and through that visit and otherwise, Holmes was not uninfluenced indeed by Freud and his work. Lasky was always more defensive about it. But after all, the unconscious was the very home of Mr. Justice Holmes' inarticulate major premise. And in these years, it's not extravagant to detect the influences at work. The literature discloses the interest of Graham Wallis, the sponsor of Lasky at the school, and of the Bloomsbury Group in international intellectual circuits, which studied the new schools of psychology seriously, and not always meaningfully, as in the case of a correspondent in Vienna who wrote, "Slips of the tongue has become the party game, and the Oedipus complex is so much the rage that everyone wants to have his own." But in 1926, this period ends, at any rate in labour law. The judge's truce ends, notably when Mr. Justice Astbury declared the general strike to be illegal, a dictum so wrong in law that it was demolished by Professor Goodhart. Perhaps I should rephrase that, but let it stand. Thereafter, trade union influence was weak. Middle-class acquiescence of the social structure saw no need for new labour legislation. But later, in the Second World War, in 1942, the needs of the country ensured that the law lords abstained once again in the Crofter case, confining the tort of conspiracy, as it was not difficult to do, so as to avoid tortious liability at the height of the war for large employers and the nation's largest trade union, the two together. Many thought this was a resurrection of some lasting judicial abstention, which would continue beyond the 1950s, and that the common law creativity against trade union organization was dead and gone. But the phylogenetic character of judicial interventionism as a common law process to combat working class collective organization gushed forth again in the 1960s, just a decade after Lasky's death, marking a renewal of 19th century repressive tendencies, as Karl Freund put it, in a state somewhat of shock at the time. Yes, this was a beginning in Rooks and Barnard in the middle of the 1960s. We have seen further interventions beyond that in the 1980s, with a marriage of common law judicial creativity to a new brand of legislation which treats trade unionism as an obstacle to the de-collectivization of the labour market. The two, as it were, work together where before statute and common law worked as a pendulum. Much overlooked in the later work of Lasky are his remarkable warnings in the 1940s, alone of writers, I believe, of the likely renewal of such interventions. By the 1940s, he broadened his inquiry, emphasizing that the common law was, for the most part, surely made by the owners of property in their interest. Not, and this was always a mark of him, not because of any particular selfishness special to them, but because in history you could find a dominant class tended to equate the public good with their own good. Lasky also tried to warn his colleagues of such problems as limitations to the victory at the ballot box of 1945 and the need to take a swift social change, until Mr. Attlee eventually told him, after the manner of some Labour Party leaders down the years, though not all, a period of silence on your part would be welcome. Class and private property now had a higher function in Lasker's analysis of the common law. As for the judges, he challengingly asserted, the judiciary cannot transcend the class structure of the society in which they work. In an individualist society, concepts of tort, contract and property, he went on, cannot be transcended in a fundamental way without the society ceasing to be individualistic. Even Mr. Justice Holmes, who always was somewhat for Lasky a footnote exception to things, even Holmes, he said, could only intervene in different ways interstitially. This decisive break with his previous positions had two important consequences. On the one hand, judges like Lord Justice Scruton understood this social limitation to their work and might have a greater claim to our sympathy as against the majority who applied the common law instrumentally by the light of nature. On the other hand, since legislation and not judicial process must be central, therefore, to real change in social structures, its purposes must not be obstructed by the judiciary. There must be no room or excuse for judicial policy that frustrates a statute of that kind. No place, for example, as it happened long after his death, for the judge who in 1978 interpreted an act to compel employers to negotiate with a trade union narrowly because he thought it was analogous to laws giving powers of compulsory acquisition of property. Now, Lasky allowed, as I say, a few judges might make a few exceptions, but on the whole, the courts give effect, he said, to the conflicting class antagonisms which shape the atmosphere in which they have to work. Lord Devlin actually makes a similar point in talking of the nature of judges, talking of them being of the same type of men. There will, he says, be exceptions, of course, but the same type, whatever their school, public, comprehensive, grammar, or minor public. Lasky added to this, like land in feudal society, power in our economic oligarchy was based on the ownership of the instruments of production, and he wrote, of course, before the transnationalization of capital demonstrated the thesis in a global market. Law operated in great measure within boundaries acceptable to those interests, and he cited, and was fond of citing, the principle of common employment, whereby the judges invented the doctrine of common employment in the 1830s, whereby a servant who was injured by another servant in common employment with him could not sue the master because he was, according to the common law, taken to have consented to that kind of thing happening when he took on the employment. And Lasky, today, surely Lasky would have added the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act 1994. In his list and very high up. Great judges served the law, he said, precisely by bringing to its service a body of class prepossessions of which they were the unknowing prisoners. Their common law accepted the right of capital to combine, but denied it to trade unions. The necessary changes in society, and just as important changes, and this is important to Lasky, changes in its hegemonic concepts, could, he believed, be won by consent to replace a society in which all aspects of life are subordinated to acquisitiveness and an economic system breeding millions of unemployed, he wrote. With characteristic optimism, at the end, he asserted, hunger and fear have ceased to be instruments of discipline in society. I never said Lasky couldn't make mistakes. That may sound absurd today, but to those of you who are too young to have been there, let me add that such ambitions and beliefs were not uncommon at the time, nor did they wholly die with Lasky. Now, if the legal issues were inextricably entwined with social relations expressed in rights of property, it followed that legal change would need to be accompanied, or perhaps logically even preceded, by other changes, economic, political, and social. The need to challenge the dominance of common law philosophy was, of course, urgent, for its function was, he wrote, to protect the rights of a special class of property owners and their dependents from invasion. And this it did by making a spinal column of legal ideas, around the notion that rights are a function of property. Lasky's focus was the need for this radical change. Just as the need to retain rights of private property inviolate in a competitive market was central to the beliefs of others here at the school, such as von Hayek or Robbins, who played the part of Pope to Lasky's anti-Pope in LSE in the 1930s, and in von Hayek's case, whose ideology has been of some significance in the authoritarian labour laws of the 1980s. Hayek was for rights of private property protected by a strong state. Lasky was for public control of the means of production within a more pluralist state apparatus. Hayek accused Lasky, somewhat tastelessly, of arguments parallel to those that let the Nazis into power in Germany. Lasky took pleasure in citing in reply Keynes's remark that Hayek was the most distinguished muddlehead in Europe. By this stage, however, Lasky could not be satisfied, as he was in the earlier phase, that the Osborne case and other cases like it would have been differently decided, as he put it then, by lawyers trained to watch the juristic significance of the judgments that they make. That was not enough. The case was a judicial attempt to obstruct trade unionism, to obstruct collective organisation, which, as he put it later, the judges did not understand, and so far as they understood it, disliked. And to weaken the labour movement, whose elected representatives then received no state recompense, was also, of course, an objective. The decision suited a dominant class interest in 1910, but then, and Lasky makes this point but leaves it, but then so did the Compromise Act of 1913, which marked off a certain territory of political action as permissible for trade unions from economic activities, a limitation on which the legislature could always return to turn the screw afresh, as it did in 1984 and 1993. Lasky wrote, "There is no hard and fast line between industrial action and political action." Of course, there had been reforms. The Factories Act, limitations on certain hours of labour. Such legislation was sometimes rationalised as the growth of a social conscience. But now Lasky dismissed the idea and said that this had been brought about by a struggle, by a social struggle, and at another place, he puts, by a class struggle. We may note in passing that it was at this period, too, that Lasky entered the argument, which was quite widespread, it's often forgotten, about Anglo-American Union or a federal Europe. A lot of argument in the early and later 40s. He sympathised with the idealism, but he wrote, "Merely to enforce freedom of trade within Europe would surely stereotype the existing distribution of power. Or, indeed, it might allow the free movement of capital to obtain an advantage in different areas of cheap labour conditions. Would international capital," he asked, "be allowed to exploit backward areas at the expense of the more advanced?" And a question of the day, if British miners went on strike, would the coal owners be permitted to import Polish miners? There was a very large and interesting argument on questions of that sort, which has apparently become almost lost in the later debates on such issues. But this brings us to the mature Lasky and his link with the common law today. In one of his last works, a series of lectures in the United States on trade unions and society in Britain and America, he offered some new perceptions. The freedom, he noticed, which many in America and Britain claimed for the working man, meant a release from his obligations as a member of a trade union, and a worker who is freed from his trade union is thereby left in servitude to his employer. In Britain, the first post-war ideological onslaught, breaking the consensus on trade union laws, came 8 years later. Lasky had been virtually alone in foreseeing it. Lasky warned, too, that the courts were still in a dual frame of mind about trade unions, seeing them on the one hand as monopolistic barriers in the way that free competition, the principles of the common law, have been promoting for something like 2.5 centuries. Like some prescient Cassandra, he half perceived even the legislative drift of 30 years later, when government has joined forces with the common law in deregulation and decollectivization. On the other hand, Lasky warned of the continuance of what had ever since 1906 constrained and made difficult any legislation which tried to afford workers a modest liberty to act collectively in trade disputes. He wrote, and you see that I here have got to my title, he wrote, "Most lawyers have a half-conscious belief that the common law provides, so to say, a law behind the law which is enacted by Parliament. There is amongst them a kind of nostalgia for the laws it stood before the Trade Disputes Act of 1906 in Great Britain, for example. A law behind the law enacted by Parliament. The tension between the common law and statute was particularly dangerous when we realised that the judge does not find the law, but makes it in the most complex and delicate realm of trade union activity." This kind of analysis is very relevant to 1995. The law behind the law claims a morally higher standing. It is Dicey's law of the land, an implicit bulwark for rights of property. But it is to misunderstand Lasky, to make him suggest, as some have in the light of this passage, that there is nothing that can be done about the matter, because the law behind the law is always more effective in the courtroom. Let me touch on three aspects of the common law which give us a chance of your judging for yourselves what could be done, if you want to do anything. It may be you do not. Several common law doctrines illustrate the manner in which the law behind the law builds in preserved memories that can only be displaced by very special therapy. Not only doctrines such as common employment that lasted for 150 years, as Lord Devlin was frank enough to say, the judges who created it didn't get rid of it but left it as a nerveless tooth which could still bite even when in decay. Recent judgments demonstrate the persistence of such phenomena. Take the doctrine of restraint of trade. The precise principles of illegality for restraint of trade at common law were first stated early in the 19th century and have been often modified by the judges. It's a totally judge-made area of law. The variations in the doctrine have always had the role of maintaining judicial control over the essential illegality of trade unions. Unhappily, in 1994, the Prison Officers Association found that someone by mistake had given the powers of a constable to their members in 1952. Unhappily, because if you have the powers of a constable, and this, one suspects, was all a matter of mistake, you cannot be within the definition of a worker. And therefore, the Association of Prison Officers, which had in fact acted for decades as a trade union, could no longer regard itself as such. Its members were not workers, and a trade union is an organisation of workers. Worse than that, the immunity against the doctrine of restraint of trade only applies, and has only applied since 1871, to a trade union. If you're a trade union, you can avoid most, at any rate, of all the difficulties of restraint of trade, but not here, because they were not a trade union. The judge held it was well established that an organisation like the POA, with rules about when and under what conditions members would work or undercut pay rates or take industrial action, was in unreasonable restraint of trade at common law. But greatly daring, and it's one of the marks of the English bar that it is frequently greatly daring, counsel argued that this doctrine is one developed by the judges themselves, so that surely a modern court could remove the illegality altogether. There's no longer any need for the common law to see restraint of trade as contrary to the public interest. What the judges had imposed, surely the judges could remove. This struck the judge as a most undesirable step. He acknowledged, and fully acknowledged, the right to form or join a union under the European Convention of Human Rights, but of course that is not directly enforceable in our law. But Parliament had long governed trade unions by special legislation, and he didn't want to upset the balance of that legislation by changing by changing the status of a union. But more follows and more important. What was more, if they strike, employees in Britain withhold their services in breach of contract of employment. And if a union induces them to do so, it acts unlawfully at common law. So he concluded, it would be strange if the common law were to treat as lawful and in the public interest an association whose very object is to negotiate with employers under a threat of committing acts which the same law regards as wrongful, i.e. threatening to induce breaches of contracts of employment. If we pause, and we do need to catch our breath, we can note what a strong reassertion this is of the doctrine, not just that trade unions encounter difficulty with the common law, but that collective bargaining itself is at root unlawful in common law. For that is what the law behind the law is saying. And the judge insisted it would be most undesirable, secondly, for judges now to hold that to reflect changes in social conditions, the common law in this field has developed and is now to the contrary effect of what has been established and acted on for so many years. Society may change, but the common law on trade unions is unbending. The strength of the law behind the law is that it does not permit changes in social and property relationships, which it has invented, or at any rate not permit them easily. If that is felt to be too determinist, one may ask at least whether it's a good idea to proceed with the problem today of trade union legality and legality of collective bargaining in the face of the international instruments of the ILO and the Council of Europe, at the very least, to which the United Kingdom is supposed to be a party. Now, secondly, there is a special failure of the English courts. It would be wrong to suggest, of course, that the courts have changed nothing in employment law, especially by use of implied terms in the employment contract, though they have, as I've suggested elsewhere, been restrained by a rather exaggerated continuity of the principles of master and servant. One example, however, is the failure of the judges to insert any implied term which would allow for the suspension of the contract of employment in a strike or other industrial conflict where the action taken is lawful, assuming that the strike and so on is lawful, should the contract be suspended. There are a lot of problems, which I will pass over, but many people will know the problems. If the contract is suspended, who can do what? But all obligations are suspended, and the commonest question that is put to you is, suppose there is never a resolution of the strike, are you suggesting it will be suspended forever? I think there are answers to those questions, but it's not the point that I want to address now. Our judges, our courts, have never, with very few footnote exceptions, even approached the suggestion that this is the case. But what is less frequently pointed out is the extent to which other comparable judiciaries have promoted the modern concept that a lawful strike involves a mutual suspension of contractual obligations of employment between employer and employee. Now, the belief is widespread that such rules suspending employment contracts in strikes exist in systems only where a constitutional provision expressly or impliedly guarantees a right to strike. And it is true that such a guarantee does exist in most of the relevant continental systems. But in many of the other systems, the right to strike inheres in the individual worker, albeit that it's exercised collectively when used, and this feature has often been introduced not by the legislature but by the courts and then taken up in legislative and constitutional provisions. That was the case in France, where the modern statutory rule, as it's put in one textbook, consecrates the case law which started in 1939. The continental jurisdictions do not stand alone. In Canada, the Supreme Court decided 30 years ago that an otherwise lawful strike does not cause a breach of contract, rendering the worker liable to discharge. And recently, the Supreme Court in Ireland clarified an uncertain jurisprudence by holding that a proper strike notice to the employer would normally save the employment contract from, at any rate, from repudiation on account of the strike. Now, why have those things happened and our courts been so particularly inflexible? Why should the French or Canadian or Irish and indeed other courts go into that territory and not the British? It's not easy to explain on the basis of Lasky's generalizations about relations of property and the like, because the differences do not come out easily between the various societies involved. Are we here in the presence of some special taboo, some special internalized, unattackable authority, deeper in the English jurisprudential psyche than in comparable systems? I don't know. Thirdly, the creativity of the common law, and this I must touch on, but I'll do so briefly. What a contrast when we look at the practice of the common law in labor relations. Other than the two short periods of so-called judicial abstentions, that is, periods in which the judges did not, on the whole, expand liabilities for workers or trade unions within and just after the two world wars. When creative law making against trade unions was resumed by the extension of tort liabilities in Rooks and Barnard, actually by Mr. Justice Sachs sitting with a jury in 1961, who was upheld by the law lords in 1964, when threats to break employment contracts became the tort of intimidation and therefore unprotected by the 1906 Act, to the amazement of most people, then one saw that notions in which everyone in their way had taken part, notions that the judiciary were not going to do this again because one couldn't test it until late in the 1950s, because the wartime legal structures went on until 1951, or indeed in some ways even later. But now, in the 60s, the law lords did that and went even further. It went even further because they interpreted the 1906 Act explicitly by reference to the power of the law behind the law. They hold that the judges' development of their own common law since 1906 can determine the meaning of the Act. If the common law went one way, said Lord Reed and a number of others, then parts of the Act might be effective in particular way. But if the common law had gone the other way, as it had, that is, the common law as pronounced by the judges had gone the other way, then the courts could treat parts of the Act as pointless or nugatory or unnecessary. Those are words from three different speeches of the law lords, and that's what they did. Now, statutory immunities, as Lord Diplock put it, are anyway intrinsically repugnant to the common lawyer. And I have never felt, and perhaps I hope what I've written about it has never suggested, that Lord Diplock was in any way prejudiced in the normal sense of the word. As Scruton said, it's not a question of partiality, it's a question of function. The intrinsic repugnance is because these immunities cut across the lines that the rights of property would normally draw on the map. And where they've offended the spirit of the law behind the law, the courts have set about changing them, such as calling for legislative change or developing new applications of underlying liabilities. We've had a few in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, including one of a new tort for inducing an unenforceable contravention of a statute in the dock strike judgment in 1989. But in 1992, the law behind the law went transnational. A ship-owning company paid sums to a union in Sweden in the settlement of an industrial dispute in which a flag of convenience ship was being boycotted because, of course, as is customary, the Third World crew were exploited in a savage manner. The industrial action was totally lawful in Sweden. But when the ship reached England, the company approached the English courts and ultimately the House of Lords and recovered the money because of the union's economic duress. The speech of Lord Gough on the new doctrine of economic duress, a liability not known to the common law before 1976, followed the lines already drawn in a leading textbook on the matter, written by Professor Jones and Lord Gough. The union might be protected in tort against claims for loss, he said, but that didn't mean it was necessarily allowed to retain an enrichment achieved by industrial action. With deep regret, with deep respect, I believe it to be unwise for a senior judge to sit on a sensitive point on which he's already given the answer in a textbook. The Canadian courts have wisely excluded economic duress from industrial conflict for fear of making the pressures inherent in free collective bargaining. In England, in labour law, we suffer from general changes also in procedures. in one sentence merely. Labour law has suffered from the changes made generally by the judges in our procedure in terms of the interlocutory injunction. That is a double-speak remedy which suggests that it's merely holding the balance until trial, when in fact it intervenes in an industrial conflict, at any rate, in a way which nearly always settles the matter, not in an interim way, as it suggests, but in a more final manner. And now, since 1975, the plaintiff, normally the employer, maybe a third party, has to show only an arguable case or a serious question to be tried. In industrial conflict, the remedy is available with little or no notice, even when the dispute may have originated weeks before. The judge is well known who granted an injunction in 1987 over the telephone from his home on a Sunday. Only a few months ago, an employer's sudden application in an ongoing dispute after a three-hour hearing ending at 10 p.m. in the judge's home in St. John's Wood gave rise to an interlocutory injunction, although I'm not, for those who live there, suggesting that there's anything specially wrong about injunctions granted in St. John's Wood. Lasky's vision on so many of these matters was very positive. He believed that if many of these social relations were changed, trade unions, he wrote, would be able to enter the field with management and concern itself with advancing the skills and outputs of its members. In society so far, he says, it's been able to do no more than defend its members, their jobs or their benefits. Today, more difficult to do that. In a planned but pluralist democracy, he saw a new role for organizations of workers, a different content in the idea of workers' freedom in industry, as he put it, more positive and less negative. He wrote in that passage about what came to be called the discussion and debate on industrial democracy. Since Lasky died, of course, gigantic changes have occurred. The command economy of the Soviet Union has collapsed. The capital of which Lasky wrote has become multinational in a global economy, and Britain has become part of the European Union. Albeit that I could only put a word of headings on the matter, it would be quite wrong of me to pass over, finally, the matter of European law. Many people believe that the attachment of the United Kingdom to the European Union, or as it is properly still called in terms of the law of this matter, the European Community, would solve many of these problems. Unhappily, it seems to me improbable that that would adequately be so. Even if the United Kingdom negotiates an adherence to the so-called social chapter, the protocol and agreement on social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty. There are, of course, many positive European features, albeit sometimes ambivalent in their effects. The directive on working time, the directives on safety at work, the requirement for consultation in redundancies with workers' representatives, the social chapter directives now on European Works Councils and paternity leave. But I venture to think that European labour law cannot, in its present structure, supply what is needed in our labour relations law, partly because of what Paul Davis and Mark Friedan have called the overall lack of coherence, although it seems to me that it's not merely a lack of coherence in the law, but the balance or imbalance of the forces at work within the community itself. The Court of Justice, for instance, has committed itself to uphold fundamental rights, and fundamental European Convention on Human Rights is mentioned now in the Treaty of Union. But there's little to encourage the idea that the court will enforce a specific set of collective labour rights against any member state. Of course, one can't pass over the most secure fundamental rights, equality between men and women, secured because equal pay and then non-discrimination had a basis in the Rome Treaty, though incoherently there's no parallel place for race discrimination as there should be, or even for discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. Secondly, the Commission in 1989 committed itself to the view that all member states enjoyed rights of freedom of association, liberty of collective bargaining, and rights to strike. The ILO experts annually prove this to be a deficient analysis, especially in, but not only in, the case of Britain. Thirdly, European instruments, of which one purpose is the protection of employees, often turn out to be as much, if not more, designed to harmonize costs or to integrate the economic market. The Luxembourg Court pointed this out in the 1994 decision against the United Kingdom, compelling us to adopt measures to designate workers' representatives. The directive involved, it said, a collective dismissal consultation, was both to secure comparable protection for workers' rights in different member states and to harmonize the costs which such protective rules entail for community undertakings. Perhaps even the activist judiciary in Luxembourg cannot easily transcend the social relations that surround it. And then again, analysis has recently shown how the so-called social dimension of the community has been conditioned by the rules concerning free market competition and free movement of goods, services, and capital. One judge of the court has been quite explicit about the judiciary's policy orientation on these matters towards full integration and the role of the senior judges in dissolving any doubts about new judges who arrive who are of a more timorous disposition. Lastly, the social policy protocol, the social chapter, confirms this analysis. True, it extends the competence of majority decisions. True, it extends the use, possibly, of collective agreements as part of a social dialogue, although how exactly we're not yet sure. But there are certain matters excluded from its central machinery of decision-making which go to the root of a labour law system. Excluded from the social chapter altogether are the right of association, the right to strike or lock out, and pay. Now, some writers say that it's a matter of regret that these rights are excluded. It's much more than that. It is an intentional tragedy. The prospect of such collective rights acquiring transnational effect is greatly reduced by the failure of that omission. Finally, then, let me say that, in truth, these factors reinforce the notion, at the very least, that an alternative British labour law that takes collective rights seriously, that changes the direction from individualism of an extreme kind towards a collective base of the labour market, will need substantial legislation at Westminster, not merely a lazy reliance on phrases in instruments from Brussels. At European level, there is also the danger that trade unions are coming to be seen primarily not as negotiating bodies, but as consultative purveyors of information to their members, and in the union as impediments to competition in the economic market. Industrial conflict may, indeed already is, removed from the practices that unions at European level are encouraged to think about. The realities of social division, however, and conflict of interest, which Lasky puts before us, cannot be made to disappear by some paper fiat, wherever the source. An alternative labour law programme will need to affect the power relationships at the place of work, and a new look at Lasky can help us, I believe, to envisage what might be put forward. It must include, from the early Lasky, more training, not merely of lawyers, but of judges, on the questions of industrial relations and the law in respect of it. After all, after 1973, Italian judges with a labour jurisdiction have been required to undergo substantial training annually in labour relations law and the history and sociology of the trade union movement. And what's good enough for Italy on this, I'd have thought, would be good enough for us. And, of course, in looking at these realities, the judges must look at what is really meant today by subordination in employment. Zero-hours contracts, other precarious employments, which must surely be restricted by the law. Scandalous practices, where young people are being paid a pittance only for the minutes in which they are actually called upon to work at the place of work. Judges must be made to see that these are practices which are not in accordance with a civilized society, nor are they necessary for economic renewal or the like. And in any revision of our labor relations law, we shall need, of course, positive rights and immunities to enact collective rights at minimum ILO standards, a right to organize, right to bargain, and to strike. So practical reform must relate both to the subordination of real individuals and also to the position and the relationship of, in Marx's phrase, the industrial reserve army, which, although its numbers go up and down a bit, is now becoming a feature which looks almost permanent in this type of society. We need codes of law which have relationship to these realities, millennialist codes for reform of labour law, which struck far ahead of general social change, are likely to be divisive and collapse under the weight of their own rhetoric. But structural reform must also address the law behind the law, and it will not surrender easily. A last word from Lasky. The one gospel he wrote towards the end, that always brings a sense of hope, is the gospel that all things must be made new. That is the ambition which creates a feeling of real liberation, because the adventure itself is freedom. And in that spirit, he left us also with a favourite from Harold Nevinson. Human freedom must be conquered anew every day, like love. But we're always losing freedom, as we are always losing love, because after each victory, we think we can settle down and enjoy it without any further struggle. Well, we cannot afford such mistakes. We must never forget, as Nevinson put it, that the battle for freedom is never done and the field is never quiet. Thank you.
May I thank Bill Wedderburn on behalf of everybody here for a magnificent lecture. If I may say so, an absolute tour de force. The old master has still got it. And if I may be permitted one very trivial footnote, and it is that to be fair to Mr. Justice Sachs, if it's necessary to be fair to him, he almost certainly did not appreciate what he had done in 1961. Until after he read your articles in the Modern Law Review. Could I invite everybody here to a reception in the senior common room, which has very kindly been provided by Messrs. Pattinson and Brewer, the solicitors, Pattison and Brewer. I'm speaking for them in the hope that you'll produce all your trade union work for them, and there'll be somebody there to receive your instructions. But they have very kindly provided... Nobody dare criticise me for being anti-solicitor or anything like that. That we shall have this reception upstairs, and I hope you'll all come along and get a chance to interrogate the good Lord. Thank you very much indeed.